Today is February 25th, 2014. This is Desiree Hargis on behalf of the H.J. Lutcher Stark Center for Physical Culture and Sports. As part of the 1968 U.S. Olympic Team Legacy Archive, I am interviewing Mickey McFadden over the phone about her experiences in the 1968 Olympic Games in Mexico City. Mickey, can you begin with when and where you were born?
I was born in Honolulu, Hawaii. And in January 24th, 1948, so when I was on the Olympic team, I was 20.
Oh, wow. That's very young.
Yeah. Of course, I didn't think so then, but looking back, yes.
Can you tell me a little bit about your family and where you grew up?
Yeah, I grew up in Honolulu, so I had a very outdoor living, surfing, ocean. My mom was a PE teacher. My dad was in sports, so I was always encouraged. I had a brother, three and a half years older. And, you know, we did sports, all kinds of sports and outdoor activities were in my upbringing. My mom was a swimming teacher, so I was in the ocean very young.
Mm-hmm. And how did you first get involved in your Olympic sport?
I belonged to the Outrigger Canoe Club. And when I was 10 or 11, I joined. A lot of my friends were there and they had sand courts, you know, beach volleyball courts. So on the days that the surf wasn't up, and we weren't out surfing, and the club was right at Waikiki. So it was just, you'd either walked out and you surfed, or if the surf wasn't up, you stayed at the club and played some sand volleyball. And at the time, and even now, the club had what they call a baby court, which is a smaller court with a shorter net, and all the kids could play on that court. So the Outriggers produced a lot of talented volleyball players. Many have been Olympians. And that's where I started, and it was guys and girls co-ed, and if you won, you stayed on, and if you didn't, you were off. So, you know, you got competitive.
Yeah. So who are some of the other Olympians that have, come out of that club?
Tommy Hayne, Pete Velasco, who played a lot of tournaments there. They were 68ers. John Stanley, who wasn't living there then, but is now. Let's see. Out of the Outriggers. Well, there's a lot of Hawaii girls, but on the team, Bobby Perry and Fanny Hopiao, they didn't really play beach. But then since then, a lot of the younger kids, I'm blanking. You should have given me questions earlier. I could look them up. But a lot of the younger, you know, since the 68 team, there's been several Olympians out of Hawaii that are just started at the beach, playing sand. And now that it's a beach sport, you know, there's several that have come out of there. Stein Metzger, grew up on those courts and ended up playing in the Olympics in the two-man beach volleyball. But, you know, in that day, there wasn't beach volleyball in the Olympics. So you had to carry your beach skills into being an indoor player.
Uh-huh. When did you first start playing indoor volleyball?
Well, we weren't allowed to be on the volleyball team in high school until we were sophomores. They had a rule for some reason that freshmen could not be varsity players. So I started when I was a sophomore in high school. And that's pretty late these days now that they have kids, you know, playing club 10 and under. But that was when I started playing indoor. It was just beach before then. And then high school, sophomore, junior, senior. That was it.
And so high school, was that when you first received formal coaching in volleyball?
Yes, pretty much. And then when I came to my senior year in high school, Hawaii sent a team, a women's team, to the nationals for the first time for the national tournament. And I was lucky enough to be part of that. And so I got some recognition at the first national tournament. And then when I came to college, I went to USC, and when I came to school, they said, oh, they're having tryouts for the World Games team, you know, the national team going to the World Games in Japan. And I just happened to be in the right place at the right time. I actually only applied to UCLA and SC because I knew the sports I wanted to do were in Southern California. So that was, you know, I had that in my brain, but I did get a nice opportunity to get on that first team, and then, you know, got my foot in the door. So
tell me about the Olympic trials. How did you make it to the trials? And then once you were at the trials, what was the process and how was the team chosen?
Well, we have a national tournament every year, and it's different now because they pick a national team and they train much of the year together. And then they go on a lot of traveling. Probably half of the year is traveling to different countries and playing in these big international tournaments. And then, you know, there wasn't any money in the program. And so at the national tournament, which is held every May, they picked an all-star group. They picked 18. And then we all trained all summer. And they picked the team from that. So pared it down to 12. We went to Tahoe right before the Olympics to train high altitude, since the Olympics was in Mexico City. They wanted to do some high altitude training. So we trained in Tahoe for a couple weeks, and they did the final team selection there.
I see. Were there any challenges or problems in that process that you saw?
Well, yeah, there were a couple players that quit. Personality problems. There was another problem was that all of us were either students or teachers, working people or students. I was a student at the time, but a lot of these women, the older women, were, you know, had full-time jobs, and they weren't released from their jobs. This was not, it was like, sorry, you gotta come to work. So they had to work around it. And one of the gals, one of our best players, it was really unfortunate. She had a commitment with her school, with the teachers thing. And she was told, you either come to the practice or you can't be on the team, which was pretty harsh. And so she said, hey, I'm sorry, I have to go to my teacher's commitment. And she didn't come. And that was really a shame. She really was our best hitter. So there were some problems going in, and then some personality, a couple personality things where someone said, I'm done. I'm not going to, you know, not seeing eye to eye with the committee or the coaches. So that was, you know, those things happen in the world of sports. And, yeah, that did happen that year. So
that's too bad. So in terms of the altitude of Mexico City, how did you prepare for that? Did it factor into your training at all?
Well, it did. We went to Lake Tahoe for a couple of weeks to train and live and train in South Lake Tahoe. And boy, it was hard. I mean, when we went from Los Angeles, where we basically were training, to Tahoe, and I remember just, you know, we'd have to run, you know, go run a mile. Oh my gosh, it was really hard. You know, you felt like you were completely starting from scratch and totally out of shape, but it was just that we weren't used to the lack of oxygen. So I'm not sure if it was good that we did that, and it prepared us somewhat. And I felt sorry, you know, I feel really bad for the runners. I'm sure they probably took more time to get themselves acclimated to the altitude, but for us, yes, I did feel the effects of that. And then once we got to Mexico City, I don't recall that it was, you know, when you're playing and you're in and out of the game. You're not running and doing all the several hours of practice. You're not feeling the effects as much. So I don't recall it was that big a deal in Mexico City. I'm sure it was for the marathon runners.
Yeah. So how did your friends and family and, you know, people who knew you at school, how did they react to finding out that you were going to compete in the Olympic Games?
Well, by then I was gone from my high school friends, and I was only, you know, a couple years out of high school. So my college friends, they were, you know, excited about it. High school, some of the people that I still was in touch with, they were excited. My family actually, my parents were already going to the Olympics. They, regardless of if I made it or not, they had already planned to go just to be spectators. So that was really great. You know, they got to be there and be involved in watching and, you know, opening ceremonies and all that stuff. So that was really exciting. That was a great thing that happened for them.
Yeah, absolutely. You had mentioned that your mother was a swimming teacher and that your father was involved in sports. What sports was your father involved in?
Well, they both went to Oregon State. My dad played basketball. What else? I don't know. I think he did probably basketball, baseball, football, you know, did all the basic sports. My mom swam and then became a swimming teacher, taught at the YWCA in Hawaii. That's how they got over there. They moved to Hawaii after she worked a summer in Hawaii in like 1929, I think. And then they wanted her to stay and said, oh, I got to finish college. So she went back and finished her last year at Oregon State and then came back because she loved it. She fell in love with Hawaii. So they got married over there. They'd been going together since, I think, sixth grade.
Oh, wow.
And they lived in Corvallis and, you know, went to Oregon State. And then they moved to Hawaii, started a new life there. So that was pretty exciting.
Yeah.
I'm glad they did. It was a great upbringing. I loved living, you know, growing up in Hawaii and having all that opportunities of the outdoor life.
Yeah, absolutely. It sounds wonderful. So you described a little bit some your Olympic teammates and the personalities there. Was there anyone on the team with whom you were particularly close?
I was pretty close with Sharon Peterson, who now lives in Hawaii. She was lived in L.A., Long Beach area, but she ended up getting a job because of our first trip that we went on together to Japan. We went through, I was a freshman in college and made this first team and went to the World Games in Japan. And we stopped in Hawaii to do an exhibition and on our way to the games. And I just got to be good friends with Sharon. And she ended up getting a job in Hawaii at Punahou School and teaching there for years. And she's now on the Big Island of Hawaii living and still coaching some boys' teams. And she ended up being the coach at University of Hawaii Hilo for years. So, you know, we either had girls that were born and raised in Hawaii, like Bobby Perry and Fanny Hopiau and myself, or we had a couple of transplants. Mary Perry ended up teaching in Hawaii. She just passed away a couple of years ago. And she had, kind of ALS. Parkinson's, like a really bad form of Parkinson's, and she was a great athlete.
But. Oh, sorry to hear about that. I think Tom told me you presented an Olympic flag at her memorial service, and you also spoke at her service.
Yes. Yeah, because I mean, I live in Oregon, and it was about a 3 or 4 hour drive. But you know, I'm the closest. Was the closest one to where she lived, Ashland. And I live in Sisters, which is kind of central Oregon. But I went down there and, it was sad, but it, you know, it was great to meet all her family and some of them that I didn't know. And I passed on a lot of stories, volleyball stories and Olympic stories to them, which they were grateful for because they, you know, they had cousins and her nieces and nephews who she was really wonderful to. They were happy to hear some things about her. So,
mm-hmm. Well, if anything comes to mind as we're going through these questions about Mary, please feel free to share some memories of her as well. So as you were preparing to go to Mexico City and you were in Lake Tahoe, while you were there in Lake Tahoe, do you remember hearing anything about possible protests or boycotts by members of the U.S. track team?
Yeah, a little bit more when we got, you know, when we got there. And I actually ended up being pretty good friends with John Carlos, who was, you know, one of the Black Glove protest athletes.
Right.
Tommy Smith, you know about all that, right?
Yes.
Or are you learning about it?
Yeah.
Okay. So I got to be good friends and we hung out and, you know, I asked him because I was young. I was really young and I was really naive and I had no idea what was going on. But, you know, we heard stuff. Oh, they're upset and they're going to do something. And so I said, well, John, what, you know, what are you going to do? And he goes, I don't know. They were being kind of directed. He at least was being directed by other players, higher ups in the African-American group, you know. So he didn't really know. He says, I don't know. We're going to do something. So I don't know when they decided to do what they did. And I was in the stands when it happened. And to me at that point, I personally didn't think it was that big a deal. I think the media got a hold of it and just blew it up. But I just thought, oh, they're, you know, they're showing, they're protesting their treatment. And, you know, really, I saw it and thought, okay, well, that's what they're doing. And then it, you know, it just blew up. So, and now it's totally changed. Now there's a big statue of them at San Jose State and they're honored, totally honored. So, you know, the world changes and how people view things changes. And that was just in 1968, as you obviously know, you're doing studying on it. It was just a volatile time. And I didn't realize as much. Almost didn't realize why we had our Olympics were in October at that point because there was student unrest and there was riots and all that. I didn't really get that because we're in Lake Tahoe. We're playing volleyball. I mean, I don't know.
Yeah.
And we were told this and went, oh, okay. So I didn't ever feel unsafe or anything there. You know, we're in this village and it's kind of protected, but some of the other people said, yeah, do you remember there were guards outside our dorm? And you know, I didn't really think about it. I didn't feel unsafe. Maybe that's very naive of me, being 20. Mm-hmm. But there was a lot going on, yeah.
Yeah, so you mentioned the student protests. So did you hear anything about the student killings and violence in Mexico City about 10 days before the start of the games?
You know, heard a little, but there was, I didn't see evidence of it when I was there. So it's kind of like, oh, is this the store? I didn't feel it. I heard about it. Didn't understand it. Didn't know what was going on. Like I said, I was not a political person at that point.
Mm-hmm.
I was just training in my sport.
Yeah.
And, you know, that was it. And looking back, I see the history that went on. Looking back at that time, but at the time I was in it, I didn't get it.
Yeah. Well, that's understandable. What were your impressions of Mexico City and its people when you first arrived?
Everyone was friendly and little kids were out and they wanted autographs and, you know, it was exciting for me. I'd been on one trip, but this was, you know, this was a huge deal. And, everybody that I encountered was friendly. The other athletes, the people, everything was just exciting. You know, I went to every event that I could when we weren't playing. I went to a lot of the track because I loved watching the track and they had an athlete section and I just thought that was cool. So we'd catch the bus, they had shuttles and we'd catch the bus and go over there and come back and then if we had to go train somewhere or warm up or have a practice, we'd get on a bus. And so we were just taken everywhere. And it wasn't, a couple nights where I went out and had maybe dinner with a group of people in a taxi, or my parents, you know, with my parents one night. So I didn't feel any negative when I was there, except that the negative against the guys that did the black glove, you know, raising in protest. Uh-huh. Then the next day when I saw them being shuffled into a van and said, "Hey, where are you guys going?" And he said, "They're sending us home." And I was kind of like, "What? Wow." You know, I just didn't realize how much of a big deal they made this mm-hmm. at the time.
Mm-hmm. What did you think of the event venues and athletic facilities?
I know that many athletes got sick. They tried not to drink the water, but, you know, whatever happened. The facilities weren't great. I mean, there was problems with, you know, I think they barely finished them. And it was, there was like one big dorm room, which I'm not complaining about. I'm just, the toilets were not always the best. And some of the athletes, I didn't get sick, but several of my teammates did. The food, I don't even remember that it was bad or good, or, you know, I wouldn't say rave and say, wow, there was just, it was a big buffet, you know, you picked what you wanted, and I didn't expect anything gourmet. I mean, I don't know, these days they probably do better with it, but, I thought it was fine. I mean, you know, when you're there and you're 20 and you're just involved in this whole exciting time, I didn't really care much about what the food was like, or just the fact that all the athletes went, and I would just sit and kind of stare around, look around and look at athletes from Soviet Union or, you know, everywhere. Maybe you get good on a bus and go to an event and try to talk to somebody, because most other people spoke some English and I spoke some Spanish. So I was kind of our interpreter if we went somewhere, had to get to a place to eat or something. So that was kind of fun.
Yeah. What are your most vivid memories of the opening ceremony?
Well, it was really exciting to walk into the stadium. And I actually found my parents in the stadium. And, you know, it's just this huge stadium of people that are cheering for you walking in. And then the other kind of funny thing is that they didn't have the big media hypey opening ceremonies like they do now with all the lights and all that. You just marched in and then, you know, they'd welcome you and that. But they also let all the pigeons go. And so people that had been in the Olympics before, some of them said, "Okay, put your purses, put something on your head, because the pigeons are going to let go and they just poop all over you." So I thought that was pretty funny. So, you know, rocking in the stadium, we're lined up and we had to cover, you know, duck and cover for the pigeon release.
Yeah. I've heard about that one before.
Yeah.
So did you have any memorable interactions or experiences with members of other national teams?
We got to be pretty friendly with, well, I said, John Carlos, you know, the track team, I got to be good friends with them. And then the German volleyball team, some of the girls got to be friendly with. And I had an experience just 15 years ago or so. I was still playing Masters volleyball and went to the, I guess it was called Masters Championship or something. And there was a team from Germany with several women from the Olympic team. So this is in our 50s, you know, reacquainting at another tournament. And that was pretty cool, you know, and then very friendly, very, you know, we competed against each other, but then everybody's being friendly. So that was neat. And I remember a guy from, the Netherlands, really friendly guy. I think he was played soccer or rugby or something. And he just happened to be on the bus. Obviously you couldn't really chat if they didn't know English. I couldn't, but mostly it was just, most of them did. So you know, just getting to know some of the other athletes are just, that's what I love about the Olympics. And I hate that political stuff because the athletes just want to go and compete and be and get to know each other. And it's the politicians that want to make it a statement, political statement.
Yeah. So given that 1968 was the height of the Cold War in Vietnam, what effect, if any, did this political climate have on the games and interactions between athletes?
I didn't feel any. I think that we were kind of not a beginning team, but we weren't in the national spotlight at that time. The Japanese team, the Russian team, the European teams were higher up at that point. They were paid professional athletes, and we weren't. Like I said, everybody on our team was a working person, and we just trained after hours when we could. So we hadn't caught up yet. So you know, we were beaten by most of those countries. So I don't think there was any, you know, I think if you're in a tight game where maybe they're going to win, maybe you're going to win, maybe there's a little more animosity or something, but we didn't feel it. I don't think the athletes really, we had good relationships with the Japanese team. They would come through and we'd play them every so often. And the Russian team, as far as being a player, there wasn't a problem at all. So I didn't feel any of that. I don't know if the coaches felt it. I don't think so. I really don't. I really feel like it was more the politicians and what the media made out of that, not the athletes.
Mm-hmm. So you talked about the German volleyball team. Was that West Germany or East Germany?
Who was in it? I don't know. Probably West.
Okay.
I don't even know. I don't even know if it was a split thing or if it was just one German team.
What did you do immediately after your event was over? Did you celebrate or relax? Did you do any sightseeing or did you?
No. When all of that was over for me, and I had to because the games were in October, I had to take a semester off of school because it had already started. It was right in the middle of my semester, and I was going to USC, and it was really hard. I was very, I don't get depressed or, you know, I don't have a problem there, depression or anything, but I was really down. It was very hard to get back into everyday functioning life when all you've done is get up, train, eat, train, go to bed. You know, all you're doing is that for months and months. And then the intensity of the coaching and the training and the competing, and you just have your brain is just on that mode. And when it's done, it's just done. And when I hear that about other athletes, I totally get it, because now you have to figure out, you know, what am I going to do with my life? And I was in school, but like I said, I wasn't going to be in school until January, and we ended in October. And I sat around. It was really difficult to kind of, I don't know, get motivated to go out and work out or anything. So I had a few months of hard time, and then when school started again, you know, got back into it and got. Then, you know, volleyball starts again. You get on your club team and with your friends, and then it's, you know, it worked itself out. But it was very hard.
Mm-hmm. 1968 was one of the first games at which drug testing was implemented. Do you recall any experiences around that?
Well, yeah, I was chosen, and I don't have any problem that way. I just went in, peed in the cup. That was it. I was done. But I had teammates who had played a lot and sweat a lot. And I had one teammate, this is kind of funny. She was picked, you know, it was random pick. Okay, you two, you're in there. And she could not go. She could not give him a sample. So literally, and this was during the day, and this nurse had to follow, stay with her all day long. Finally, I mean, we're in our dorm room. It's like midnight. And finally, you know, they gave her water and orange juice and all this stuff, and this nurse stayed with her. She did not leave her side so that there would be no, I guess, cheating involved or something. And finally, you know, she went, and we all cheered. It was really pretty funny, but... yeah, that was definitely a, you know, thing, something going on there. So, yeah, it was pretty funny with her, but for me, I didn't have a problem.
Yeah. So, also unique about 1968, gender verification was introduced and implemented in the Summer Games. Do you recall anything about that?
I do recall they did some testing on, picked some people, or maybe everybody got, I don't know if we all got through it or they randomly picked. I remember them picking this Patty Bright, whose husband was also on the team, on the 68 team, and they had a dog, they had just had a baby, and they picked her for gender verification. We were all laughed, like, okay, you know, can you... pick the one person that has a husband here and a baby and you want to know if she's okay, you know. We kind of laughed about that, but yeah, I do remember that. I don't know, you know, of anyone else, but we kind of laughed about Patty being picked out.
Mm-hmm. So it sounds like your, you know, attitude towards it was just one of just kind of humoring it. Was anybody troubled by it or, you know, bothered by the implication or the process?
No, I mean, not that I know of. We all just were kind of like, oh, whatever. I mean, okay, you know, this is what they're doing. All right. I don't think anyone was nervous about it on our team, for sure. Mm-hmm. I feel like I did some studies myself on some of the Soviet Union athletes, the track athletes, and there was definitely stuff going on there. So, I mean, like I said, our team was like, yeah, whatever. Okay. Well, what do you need? You know, mm-hmm. We don't have anything to hide. So, but I'm sure there were probably some nervous teams, nervous people.
Mm-hmm. What about the treatment of women athletes in comparison to their male counterparts? Were there differences, noticeable differences or anything unfair about it?
In volleyball, I don't think so. You know, we're all good friends. Like I said, we had a husband and wife on our team. We all knew the guys. Every year we'd go to nationals and, you know, you'd get to know these women and men. And for our nationals and for our teams, it was pretty equal. You know, they weren't getting more of anything. So I think the one thing... for the nationals for a while, and now it's different, is that they had a master's division, probably because they had more players, more guys were playing. And we didn't have a master's division till after they had it for several years. But other than that, the treatment on the Olympic team and, you know, what we got and where we were and all that was pretty equal, mm-hmm. I think.
For you, did you notice any big differences for women in volleyball for pre-Title IX versus post-Title IX?
Well, just the fact that then, you know, girls were starting to get scholarships, became an NCAA sport, you know, that was big. You know, that was a big deal. And for volleyball, it wasn't like basketball where maybe it was men's teams had been around for a long time and then women are trying to come in and get equal, because there wasn't a lot of men's teams and all of a sudden women came in. And volleyball is more has been a women's sport with men's teams coming in. So... I feel like when they did the Title IX, they definitely got girls started getting scholarships and, for college, that opportunity, which we didn't have before. So that was a huge step, mm-hmm. after the Title IX thing came in. I mean, I went to college and didn't get any scholarship to play volleyball, and I was in the Olympic team 2 years later. So it just wasn't how it was, you know.
Yeah.
But now, gosh, it's just everywhere, the whole country, you know. Lots of women playing, lots of club teams, and opportunities for scholarships. So, mm-hmm. Yeah, Title IX just busted things open.
So you mentioned going to a lot of other events, especially the track and field events, and witnessing the Smith and Carlos winning their race. Did you see any other record-setting events or special athletic accomplishments?
Yes, I did. I saw Bob Beamon do his world record that held for 30 years or some such.
Awesome.
In the long jump. Yeah, I mean, I was in the stands watching him and directly watching, which, you know, on track, lots of things are going on at the same time. But I was watching him, and I saw him, when I see replays of it, I remember distinctly seeing him jumping up and down, and I said, oh, gosh, that must have been a good one. You know, and then it's this world record that held forever and ever. It was just the high altitude and just a perfect jump and all that. But, and then Bob Segrin in the pole vault. I don't know. I mean, I watch as much, to watch the 100. I watched any time I could get to the track, you know, I would go. So mm-hmm. I'm sure there's other things. If you said, did you see this or that? I'd go, oh yeah, I did see that. But those are the things that, you know, and I saw Tommy and John in their 200.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I love that. That's the ceremony of the track competition is just, you know, really exciting.
Yeah.
And you couldn't get into gymnastics. I mean, you couldn't even get a ticket. Even if you're an athlete, that was one thing you couldn't. You could freely go to track if you're an athlete. You could get in for nothing. It was hard to get tickets for gymnastics. Kind of hard swimming. I wonder, I'm trying to think if I probably tried to go to some swimming. And a lot of times it was just because it conflicted with when we were, you know, we were playing. So went to what I could.
Yeah. So for you personally, what was the most meaningful or memorable part of being on the 68 Olympic team?
Just that, being on an Olympic team, just something I had wanted to strive for, knew about. I was into sports from a young age, and I think when I was, I don't know, 9 or 10 or something, 11, 12, I told my parents, I want to be on the Olympic team. And I thought I would be on it as a swimmer. I mean, that's because I swam from 8th grade on and was doing pretty well, and even when I went to college, I wasn't sure if I was going to keep swimming or play volleyball. But like I said, I got this opportunity my senior year in high school, being on this team from Hawaii, going to the Nationals. We came in third, got some recognition. And then they said, hey, we're going to have these tryouts for the World Games team going to Japan. I went, well, that sounds pretty good, you know, never mind the swimming. So I kind of dropped that and kept my, you know, kept going after the volleyball. And then once I made that, then that was it. I just stayed doing that.
Mm-hmm.
And just really meeting other athletes, watching some of the awesome events, like some of the track I saw, just, you know, that I look back and it's the history of it is just, wow, I was there. You know, that was pretty amazing.
Mm-hmm, absolutely. What are your experiences or most vivid memories of the closing ceremony?
You know what? This is very unfortunate for me. And looking back, I would never do this again. They needed some of us to go home early. I can't remember why. And I did. And I ended up on a plane. I missed the closing ceremony. I went home early and got on a plane with a bunch of athletes, different track swimming, different athletes. And we went to Chicago just like one day, one night, we went to a President Nixon campaign dinner, if you can believe that.
Huh.
They chartered a plane with a bunch of Olympians. We went to this dinner in Chicago, and it was to support Richard Nixon.
Interesting.
And I went, okay, all right, so, you know, get off one, get on another. And yeah, really crazy. And then came home. I think we came home that night. I don't even think we spent the night there.
Huh. So did
it
you...
It was just one of those whirlwind. I look back and go, okay, I barely remember it, but I do remember it. I remember being on there and actually kind of connecting with some other Olympians that were on the plane. You know, like, why are you here? Well, I don't know. We just sounded fun. They said, would you go? And we said, yes. So we had to get in our uniforms and kind of be introduced at his campaign dinner.
Did you meet Nixon?
I did meet Nixon.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I met him in Los Angeles when he came through, and I shook his hand and, you know, the whole thing. Kind of bizarre, but yeah.
Yeah.
I did meet him.
Hmm. So can you kind of give me a summary about what happened with your athletic career after the 68 games?
Yeah, I stayed on with the national team through 1971. And it still was where we would go to nationals and compete on our club teams, and then we would be picked to go to whatever event was coming up. So it was the Olympics. Then in 71, it was the Pan American Games in Cali, Colombia. So I was in the middle of getting my master's degree at USC and training that summer. It was really another difficult trying to do many things at once. By then I was teaching at Marlboro School in Los Angeles, girls' school, coaching, teaching, going to school and trying to train. So I did make that team, and my knees were getting pretty wrecked by then. So the heavy training was hard. So after that, I retired from the national team, that level, and just went to nationals, played for fun, and every summer I'd play at the beach and did really well on the beach. My partner, Kathy Gregory, who was, one of the legends in beach volleyball, and played some indoor. She actually went on the Cali Columbia, was on that team also. And we were beach partners for pretty much the 70s.
Hmm.
So a lot of beach, and then play indoor, and then go back to the beach kind of there until... I had my sons in 1975 and 1979, and I still played beach through that. And then after that, in the 80s, I kind of just did some masters indoors. We'd get a bunch of friends together and say, hey, let's go play. And so I did that for a while, into my 50s.
Hmm.
And then my knees are so bad now, I can't.
Oh.
I still coach. I have two daughters. I coach them. I coach sisters high school volleyball. And I coach club. My one daughter's 16 and my other daughter's 14. And I still coach. So.
Awesome.
Yeah, still hanging in there.
Yeah. So I wanted to talk a little bit about amateurism, how it was for athletes in the 60s and early 70s versus amateurism as it is today. What are your thoughts and reflections on this?
We all had to be amateurs in the Olympics, and there wasn't really any money to be made legally. There was no money in beach volleyball. There was no money. You know, we just did it because we loved it. We played and we loved it. And I know that the lot of teams that we competed against, European teams, Japanese teams, they were basically professional athletes. I mean, they worked for companies or were subsidized by their country. They worked for Japanese. They had, because we toured Japan, they worked for companies and played, you know, were paid to work, but a lot of their work was their volleyball. So I know we were playing against professional athletes. It was pretty tough to compete. We could compete to a certain level, but the consistency and everything they got from training a lot more than we did showed.
Mm-hmm.
So, and now it's, you know, there's girls get scholarships. So basically, I mean, maybe they're not getting paid, but that's kind of like being paid to go to school. You're playing for the school. They kind of own you, Division I, Division II.
Uh-huh.
And then our Olympic team, you know, they take care of you. You go and train and live together for all the time. And then maybe they give you a little job here and there, but you're basically playing volleyball for the country.
Yeah. So what impact has being an Olympian had on your life?
It's had a huge impact. I think in two ways. It's definitely a self-esteem builder. You know, you feel like, hey, I worked hard for something and I was successful. So just that feeling of success, not like, oh, I'm so good and I'm so awesome, but just, hey, I really worked hard for something and I gained some success and a level of, success in my chosen field. And getting jobs, I think it had a big part in getting coaching jobs, teaching jobs from the very beginning. And then credibility with players, parents, you know, I think it's been huge for me.
Well, as a coach and a mother of two female volleyball players, what one piece of advice would you give to today's Olympic hopefuls?
Gosh, you know, if you have the opportunity and you have the passion, I mean, I coach, so I see kids that are just, they love it. They are gym rats, they're whatever. They just, all they want to do, they want to play and they want to compete. Do your best, get to that point, do it now, because that window of time, it ends. And you can still keep playing the game, which is great. And it's wonderful for the social aspect, for the physical aspect, mental, you know, to be part of a team and competing. But that window of time that you can be at the very top level is just a short period of your life. And I would say, boy, if you have any, you know, give it a try. Go for it. I just saw where online I saw there was 250 athletes that just tried out for our Olympic team, women, you know, females, tried out for the Olympic team from colleges all over the country, which is great. I mean, they're giving it a try. So they'll pick this select group and but, you know, should always give it a try if that's what you want to do.
Yeah.
And, you know, the success is obviously, to me, it's not weighed by did you make the team or not, but, you know, there's different levels. Did you give it your all? Did you get to the best that you wanted to get to? And, you know, there's so much more as a coach I see now. It's the attitude, the work ethic. They're learning so many different things. But, you know, I mean, if you try and you don't make it, at least you'd be happy that you've given it your all. And if you don't try and you go, I should have done that, you know, that's what you don't want to do.
Yeah. Well, before we close the interview, is there anything else that you would like to get on the record or tell us about?
I don't know. You covered quite a bit. I just know. I mean, I feel very blessed. I feel very lucky. I was kind of at the right place and the right time. And I did have that work ethic. I would have done anything. I wanted it badly. And it made a difference, I'm sure. I was coachable. You know, I love to see kids that just are coachable and want to learn and get better. And you know, anything can happen. I see some of the kids that is kind of the underdog kid that's worked so hard and made the team. And I love that. You know, I just think that's, you hear the stories that come out. And then you see the ones that are, you know, 6'4" and have amazing ability, go, you know, that's great too. But the ones that have worked so hard and just are great teammates, great team players, you know, that's life lessons. That's really, I think that was good for me to have that team experience.
Absolutely. Well, Mickey, thank you so much for being generous with your time and your memories.
Thanks, Desiree. I'm glad you're doing this. This will be really a fun thing to hear other people's take on it too.